Hi, I'm Dr. Larry Foster, and I'm going to be talking with you on Gospel Tangents.
Violin music by Becca Greenouch.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. There are three groups who came out of New York in the 19th century with very unusual marriage practices: Mormons, Shakers, and the Oneida community. We're going to talk about these three groups with Dr. Larry Foster. He's written an awesome book called Religion and Sexuality, and this book is actually used at BYU as a textbook, as we'll find out in the conversation. So it's a really interesting book and talks about these three groups, and we'll find out how they are similar and how they are different, and they do have some big differences, especially with regards to marriage. So check out our conversation. Well, welcome to Gospel Tangents. I have an awesome guest all the way from Georgia. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Larry Foster, Dr. Larry Foster. I'm a professor at Georgia Tech and sort of an oddball at Georgia Tech because I'm probably the only professor who teaches regularly courses in religion at Georgia Tech. So people also wonder why a non-Mormon like myself would be have spent, at least four decades, more than that really, studying the Latter-day Saints without, Mormons say, without converting. Why not convert? Or non-Mormons say, why don't, you must know all the dirt, why aren't you an anti-Mormon? So I've actually written a couple of scholarly articles explaining that. And I'll try to explain some of that to you today.
My first question was, why would a non-Mormon be so interested in Mormonism?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a backdoor route. So I went to a very liberal and experimental college, Antioch College in Southern Ohio, okay, in the late 1960s, which was a very turbulent period, as I think most of you remember. Vietnam War protests, civil rights protests, other sorts of things going on. And I thought I was fairly liberal when I went to Antioch, but I decided I was the last living conservative on earth when I was at Antioch. When I was working on my getting ready to do my undergraduate thesis in history, I decided to try and see if there were any other periods in history when there had been similar sorts of tensions and confusions. I'd seen lots of people experimenting with alternative communal arrangements and read about them and visited different places, and my hobby is to just visit new and alternative religious groups and see what they're like and so forth. So I wondered if there was any other period when things were as turbulent and how they had handled them. And I discovered there was a period that was very similar to the 1960s. Surprisingly, it was before the American Civil War, in the 1830s and 1840s, and especially in New York State. New York State was sort of the California of that period. Almost anything you could find in present-day California, you could find in New York State in the 1830s and 40s. It has a hotbed of all sorts of religious and political and social experimentation. So I decided to look at two groups in that area that was sometimes called the burned over district, because there's so much revivalistic fervor burning over the area repeatedly. So I took two groups that I thought were polar opposites: the Shakers, who were a celibate Protestant semi-monastic group that basically prohibited sexual intercourse among its members and lived in separate communities apart from the rest of the society. And the Oneida community in central New York State, which developed a system of complex marriage in which they argued that all adult members of the community were heterosexually married to each other and could have exchanged sexual partners within a very complex system of controls that they actually had to make sure that nobody got too excited about any one person and they didn't form exclusive relations. And it looked like here's the two complete opposites. The Shakers are celibate, the Oneida community says go to it for everybody. And
polyamorous, would that be the way
to? No, I wouldn't call it that. No, it's much more controlled than polyamorous.
Okay.
This brings me to another point. These were religious groups. They were First and foremost, they were religious groups. They put in the alternative marital and sexual practices afterwards. But what I found with these two groups was I felt that they were really very similar in many ways. In fact, the founder of the Oneida community, with their system that one journalist described as an apparently unprecedented combination of polygamy and polyandry with certain religious and social restraints, that this John Humphrey Noyes, the founder of this group, had been influenced by the Shakers. In a lot of ways, his ideas were similar to the Shakers, except he felt that the Shakers had missed the boat, that they should have had sex. They both believed in polar opposites. One was excluding all sex, following the idea that they were modeled on the heavenly pattern, where there'd be no marriage or being given in marriage. And John Humphrey Noyes was saying, he's a Yale-trained academic. Well, what does this passage say? It doesn't say anything about sex in the afterlife. He says no marriage. What's marriage? Marriage is an exclusive relationship in which the man is viewed as owning his wife, and this is not going to exist in the afterlife. But what I found was that Noyes actually was very interested in the Shakers. He said they were the only other group other than his that even approached the heavenly model.
Oh, really?
And he had Shakers over at the Oneida community to visit, and they performed some of their stylized dances on the stage at Oneida, and he had long, serious conversations with a Shaker elder that his son remembered. He said his father never, he was always superior to everybody else, but this was a guy he treated as his equal. And what I found, my argument there as an undergraduate was that both of these groups in different ways were trying to enlarge the family. In the case of the Shakers, they did away with sex, but they kept men and women living within the same dormitory type situations, but with strict separations, with separate entrances and exits and a lot of oversight and so forth. And with the Oneida community, which people think is a free love group, they had a lot of restrictions, including regular criticism sessions to make sure people were behaving the way they were supposed to be behaving and trying to help people become better adjusted to the community. And a very complicated system of birth control that I can go into, but I won't unless you're interested. But anyhow, the upshot is, I was wondering, why is it that this is happening at this particular time? Why are many people trying to join new religious movements that are also very concerned about, and millennial religious movements that believe that the kingdom of heaven was imminent, that it was going to happen very soon, why did they get interested in these alternate sexual practices? The stereotype, of course, is that in the 19th century, everybody was very straight-laced and Victorian. That's not true for the 1830s and 1840s. The 1830s and 1840s was a period that was wide open. It was much more like the 1960s, where people were experimenting. The society was it was rapidly growing. New York State was the most rapidly growing part of the country in the 1830s because of the Erie Canal, which had been completed in 1825. And a tremendous number of people were pouring into New York State, all sorts of people from different parts of New England and elsewhere. And so there were all sorts of people with different religious backgrounds who were often quite intense about that. And by 1850, I believe it's correct, that more tonnage of goods were being transported to the east over the Erie Canal than through the entire Mississippi Valley river system. Wow. So this was New York was, like California today. It was where everybody was going, where everybody was passing through at least. And the result was that there were just all sorts of different people competing with each other on starting different new religious movements. Like the Shakers had their headquarters in near Albany, New York, and it spread out into New England and then out into the Midwest. And the Oneida community also started in a nearby area of New England in Vermont, Putney, Vermont, and then moved to central New York, at Oneida, near between Syracuse and Utica. So I was just very interested in why this was happening. And then after I finished that undergraduate thesis, I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago. And I went to this conference, anthropology conference, because I always like to go to all sorts of different, outside of history, I'm interested in all sorts of other topics too. And one of the talks was on the Mormon family by a non-Mormon, Mel Hammerberg, who gave a talk in which he argued that the Mormon religion was in many ways fundamentally about the family in a way that was much more intense than other religious groups, all of whom, of course, do deal with the family and have some concerns about the family. Almost the family was deified. I mean, it extended into the afterlife and went on for eternity, and relationships were continued in the afterlife and so forth. And so at the end of that presentation, I said, well, you know, I've just been studying these two other groups from the same period, roughly the same location in New York State, they both were introducing alternative marital practices, celibacy and group marriage, at the same time that the Mormons were beginning to introduce a form of polygamy secretly at first in Illinois later on in the 1840s. And I said, do you have any idea why so many people were that concerned about the family that they would actually join groups that had alternative systems and stay with them for a period of time? And he said, I have the slightest idea. So I decided that was my challenge. Then as I had taken a detour in graduate school, but I was back in American history by this time. And my advisor was Martin Marty, who's influential religious studies scholar and one of those go-to people that they like to get pithy quotes from television and news media. So I decided to do an attempt to try and come up with a conclusion about preliminary ideas about why polygamy was started. Why did Joseph Smith start polygamy? I put together about a 50-page seminar paper on this, and I came up with a very interesting line of argument. I argued that there were basically four different approaches to trying to figure out why polygamy started. One was a standard non-Mormon approach. You know, Joseph Smith was just oversexed, and he was using this as a ploy to have relations with lots of women and so forth. And that doesn't really work quite well, if you look at it closely, but then there was the splinter group, a breakaway group, really, from the Utah Mormon group that went west with Brigham Young, then called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, now called the Community of Christ, and they actually were led for their first 50 years by Joseph Smith's son and his mother. The mother was Emma, wife of Joseph Smith, who hated polygamy, and she taught her children to hate polygamy, and so they had a strong anti-polygamy basis and argued that their father had never had anything to do with polygamy. It was just something that Brigham Young had corrupted the church with. Mm-hmm. And then there was another argument that, of course, the mainstream Mormons would say, well, we don't know why. God wanted him to introduce polygamy, but he was commanded to do so by God, and he just trying to follow God's inscrutable commands. And then then there was another group of psychologists that would say, well, he's psychologically disturbed, and probably something was wrong with him psychologically. And everybody, I said, argued, seemed to hold one of these four points of view and think that explained everything, and they couldn't see any merit in any of the other points of view. And so I decided to try and put together an effort to explain Joseph Smith in a way that different people from these divergent points of view could find convincing, hopefully. And none of these worked completely, but all of them had something to offer. For example, Joseph Smith surely did have a strong sex drive, but lots of men have strong sex drives. So why did he decide to go to polygamy? There's lots of easier ways to have sex than just to marry women and actually take some sort of responsibility for them, and so forth. So, and he also didn't start polygamy systematically until 1841, which is about 10 years after he started the Mormon Church. So it was a rather long wait time if he was just using it to rationalize his own sexual desires. And similarly with the reorganized church, I was able to show that absolutely, I think quite definitively, that Joseph Smith clearly was involved with introducing polygamy and practicing it on a fairly large scale himself. And interestingly, he got about 30 of his closest male followers to become polygamous. But the general Mormons didn't know about it at this time, so it was a really controversial issue. But the people who say that Joseph Smith wasn't responsible for polygamy have one slight thing in their favor, and that is it was Brigham Young who made it actually work and kept it from dying out. Because under Joseph Smith, at most, maybe 100 or 200 people closest to Joseph Smith, with his permission, were practicing some form of polygamy secretly.
Brigham expanded it to the
But after Joseph Smith died, only 30 or so men, give or take a few, were actually practicing it with his authorization. But after Brigham Young took over the Mormon Church, between the 18 months between Joseph Smith's murder in June of 1844 and the departure west, the beginning of the departure west to what became Utah, the Great Salt Lake area, under Brigham Young, there was about a tenfold increase in the number of people who were authorized by sealing and other things that it's a little hard to explain to non-Mormons, to have more than one wife. And part of that, I have to say, is because they knew they were moving, they wanted to make sure everybody was somehow connected with everybody else and taken care of, and especially unattached women or this sort of thing. They wanted to make sure that they all had some sort of a connection during the very difficult move west. But nevertheless, this was without Brigham Young. Brigham Young and the other people in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles that were connected with him were the ones that really made sure that it actually continued, and then they institutionalized it in Utah. It wasn't until 1852 that they publicly announced it, 5 years after they had moved out to Utah. And then there was a big controversy for the next 40 years really, more than 40 years, until
The Manifesto
in 1890 began to put brakes on it. But anyhow, there's something about that. He wasn't totally responsible for it. It was these other people that were also involved with it that made it work. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. And similarly, the argument by mainstream LDS people that just God told him to do it, and he was just sort of mechanically trying to follow the will of God, even if he didn't know why God was wanting him to do it, he still doesn't really show a good understanding of how Joseph Smith's process of revelation worked. Typically, he would get revelation in answer to a question that he would raise or put into his mind, depending on how you want to think about it. And when he had a strong sense of what the correct answer was, he would deliver it as a revelation he had of God, from God. And so the question is, why did he ask God about polygamy? and that raises a lot of other interesting, complex questions.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Larry Foster. In our next conversation, we'll tackle the idea that some people have that Joseph Smith had to be mentally deranged in order to participate in polygamy. What does Dr. Foster think of that argument?
But you have to ask, you know, is there an assumption that anybody who would think that they wanted to introduce polygamy would automatically have to be mentally disturbed. And you know, then you'd have to say, well, all those people in the Bible were mentally disturbed, and so forth. You know, and I don't think that would hold up.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available in either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com, and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript. And over here, we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.